Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, it's time for the Columbus Arts Festival. We'll learn more about what to expect at this year's event. Jay Fox will also chat with experts about moving scams and about colorectal cancer. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Over 500,000 people attended the Columbus Arts Festival over the three-day weekend in 2025. And guess what? I was one of them. So I want you to write this date down. This year, the Arts Festival runs June 12th through the 14th. That's the 12th through the 14th of June. It's in downtown Columbus again along the Scioto Mile. Greater Columbus Arts Council Chief's Creative Officer Jamie Goldstein joins me now on Columbus Perspective to preview the event. Hello, my friend.
Hello. So nice to be back with you again this year.
Absolutely. So June 12th through the 14th. I cannot wait.
We can't either. We just love producing this event. GCAC loves producing this event for the greater Columbus community and the smiles that are on everyone's faces and just all of the wonderful art, music, dance, theater that we bring to the city of Columbus.
Miles of smiles indeed. How many years has the festival been in existence?
This will be the 64th year, and this will be my 16th year.
Boy, I'll tell you what, I can't recall a time where I didn't attend this event. How many artists take part in the festival every year?
This year we have more than 230 exhibiting artists. Those are the juried artists that come from 31 states and this year three countries. We have an artist from Hungary and we have an artist from Canada. And then we have close to 70 more artists who show their work in the big local village. So those are all Central Ohio-based artists. Some of them have tables with their work, and then there's a gallery space where you can purchase work from artists in our very own community.
So in the history of the festival, what's the farthest distance that an artist has traveled to be included in our celebration of art?
Well, you know, I think we've had an artist from Israel before. So Israel and Hungary are probably the farthest distance, but we regularly get artists from California, from Texas, from Utah, from Wyoming. These are artists who basically commit their careers and their lives to doing festivals around the country. And they're pros at it. They come in, they set up, they have these beautiful spaces that feel like small galleries on the riverfront that people can walk in and explore all of the wonderful mediums that we represent, which includes painting, photography, ceramics, glass, jewelry, sculpture. We have 15 different mediums that are represented amongst our exhibiting artists. So it's really just a stunning outdoor gallery.
I think probably my favorite part is the fact that you actually get to meet, talk, and interact with the artists, and they can tell you about their work and what inspired it.
Absolutely. They love to do that. And that's, you know, that's another thing that this takes a special kind of personality to do this. You really want to be able, you want to interact with your public. And that's why we started the Emerging Artist Program in 2011. So we train Central Ohio artists, Franklin County and surrounding counties, who want to try being a part of a major outdoor festival. They can't have participated before. We give them a boot camp. We really help hold their hand and mentors through the process, so they know what to expect as much as anyone can when they set up for the festival. And we have 19 emerging artists that are with us this year.
I know sometimes some of these booths have things that you cannot touch, which makes it you have to be very, very careful around sculpture. Would you say that this is a family-friendly event, or is it specifically geared toward adults?
Oh, 100%. The Arts Festival is always free, and we have tons of hands-on activities for kids and families. There's a whole hands-on activity village sponsored by Battelle, and kids can come down and they can try their hand at instruments. They can make bracelets, tote bags. We work with a variety of area nonprofits, both arts and non-arts, to provide these opportunities for kids. There's a stage in that area. There'll be mascots with WOSU. We just have a ton of activities. And of course, there's always great food and drink. We have more than 40 food vendors, food trucks on site this year. And Rheingeist is our beer sponsor. So they're bringing great craft brews and Pepsi, lots of non-alcoholic beverages. And then High Bank Distillery is on hand for some boozy slushies for the adults.
So in terms of food, because that's my favorite word behind art, who is new this year that we can expect yumptiousness? That's a new word to expect.
Well, we have a lot of returning favorites. Rhyme Time Popsicles is always a big hit. The Grateful Griddle is back. And our guidebook is going online very soon, hopefully within the next couple days, where people can see all of our food vendors and all of the information about the festival at columbusartsfestival.org. We have also, you know, four stages of entertainment. So there's dance, there's music, there's theater, and we have two very special performances this year, shows this year. We have the Fashion as Art Runway Show, which is returning again on Friday night at 8 p.m. That'll be on the Genoa Park stage. And we've got four Columbus-based fashion designers who will be showcasing looks. And then Columbus Jazz is coming back this year. It's been a while since they've been at the festival, to the Bicentennial Park stage for a jazz brunch on Sunday at noon.
So that website, when it goes up online, it'll have hours, parking, food, a map, so you know what to do, where to go, when to be there.
Absolutely. It's online right now, columbusartsfestival.org, and we're just continuing to add more information.
So from a business standpoint, Jamie, what is the financial impact for the city of Columbus?
The city of Columbus, so the artists who come from all over the place pay sales tax, right? So we have a sales tax benefit to the state and Franklin County. Artists sell about $2.5 million worth of work while they're on site. So that gives you a sense of the economic benefit. You know, we know this attracts tourism. We know we get about 25% of our visitors from outside Franklin County, and there's economic benefit generated there in hotel stays. The festival itself contributes to our local community. More than $200,000 goes into the hands of local creatives and performers throughout the festival. And then we also benefit our beverage servers. So we get nonprofit organizations to volunteer at our beverage stations. They do all the serving, and they benefit through a portion of their sales and tips from people. So support your beverage servers. Come down, buy lots of beer, pop, and slushies.
Wine, too, right?
And wine, too. Yeah.
You have to mention wine.
Yep. That is also my favorite.
Well, then you and I will have a glass together. Jamie, is CODA doing anything special this year?
CODA's running. So CODA, there's lots of great ways to think about getting to the Arts Festival. There's plentiful parking on both sides of the river. Take a CODA bus and just drop off downtown and walk into the festival. Ride sharing, we recommend that folks get dropped off on the west side over by Bell Street. And then, of course, we've got the Kogo bikes and other. However you want to get to the festival, you know, what's great is we're on both sides of the river, so wherever you're coming from, we're really easy to access.
Bring your sunscreen. Stay hydrated.
Absolutely.
Because it's just one of those experiences in June in Columbus where it could be 70 degrees or it could be 95. We don't know.
It's true. And we run rain or shine.
Yes, we do.
So, you know, yes, the festival runs rain or shine, and we have lots of plans to make the most of whatever weather Mother Nature brings us. But we always hope for sunshine. Oh. We've been doing our non-rain dance for a while now.
I'll bring my Claude Monet umbrella, and I guarantee you it won't rain.
I subscribe to that superstition as well.
All right, so it's a date. Umbrellas and wine together, you and
that's
I.
That's right.
All right.
Love it. That sounds good.
Again, mark those calendars, June 12th through the 14th, downtown Columbus. It is the Columbus Arts Festival 2026. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
The Better Business Bureau of Central Ohio reports that they received more than 100 complaints about moving scams in the region last year. Sadly, this is a national trend. The U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, better known as FMCSA, is renewing its push to get free practical resources into consumers' hands before they sign a contract or hand over a deposit. Through its Protect Your Move campaign, FMCSA helps individuals and families understand their rights, spot red flags, and navigate every stage of an interstate move. Ryan Snyder is the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs at the FMCSA, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jay.
Thanks for being with us. So what is the Protect Your Move campaign?
Yeah, so FMCSA's primary mission is safety, but we also want to help consumers protect their move with their household goods when you're moving your house from one state to another. It's a stressful time, and what we're looking to do is to catch any companies who are looking to scam the general public from their entire livelihoods as they're moving across the country.
How long has the campaign been in existence?
So this campaign's been on for a number of years, and we understand it's a stressful experience for anyone. So unfortunately, this does happen quite a bit, like you mentioned, 100% in 100 times already in the greater Ohio area. And we're trying to crack down on this. These potential scams, moving is stressful, and we want to make it less stressful for families.
What are the biggest red flags that we should be watching out for if we're going to hire a mover? And what steps can we take before we sign anything so that we make sure we protect ourselves?
Yeah, so there are a number of red flags, and we actually built out a whole database of red flags for anyone. It's www.protectyourmove.gov, and there's a huge checklist and helpful videos of useful information that anybody, and I recommend anybody who's going to be moving, take a look at protectyourmove.gov for all those red flags.
So walk us through what a typical scam might be.
Yeah, so the typical scam, either the mover or the broker who a family might be using, gives a quote over the phone without ever seeing or inspecting, you know, the house or the items that are looking to be moved. The mover provides a written statement or says somebody else will be providing it after loading up the truck. Obviously, you know, that's one that you want to definitely be wary of. If they're going to give you the load after they have all the information, definitely a red flag there. Or if the mover asks you to sign a blank document, also something to be wary of.
You have something called FMCSA registration for movers and brokers. Why is it important to make sure that who we're dealing with is on that list? What does that list do?
For sure. So when movers want to register as a moving company, they need to come to FMCSA and get their registration to be able to operate in interstate commerce. And with that, we verify that they are a legitimate business. They have the proper licenses to operate these big, heavy trucks. But we also can verify, you know, if something does go wrong, we know where to find them.
So what happens if I have an interstate move and the price quoted is one thing, then I get the final bill and it's a lot more, or even worse, what happens if my belongings are held hostage? What do we do then?
Yeah, so great question. We hear that far too often. And while FMCSA is limited in the amount that we can do with regards of limited authority, but we do have a devoted legal resources team who works with the state attorney's general's offices and the consumer protection offices across the country to not only document and issue violations, but to take action. And in some of these cases, this can mean revoking the licenses of these carriers. And where there is potential criminal misconduct, we actually can refer those over to the Department of Justice. And something that I think your listeners need to know is the National Consumer Complaint Database, which is nccdb.fmcsa.dot.gov. And this is where any complaint where you might have a hostage load situation or a situation which you described where the quote is vastly different from what the final bill looks like. We recommend everyone to file a complaint in those situations.
So what rights do consumers actually have throughout the moving process? We've talked about where they can go to file a complaint. And believe me, the folks in Central Ohio know the Better Business Bureau really well. What are our rights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, under the leadership of President Trump, Secretary Duffy, and Administrator Barrs, FMCSA has been increasing our efforts to crack down on scam movers and brokers looking to extort customers. Like you mentioned, this looks like demanding additional fees above the agreed upon amounts, looking for folks who are holding their goods hostage. And what we're trying to do is just crack down. And the bottom line is there are companies out there looking to scam customers out of their money and possessions. And we're working hard to educate consumers to help them out of these traps.
So I go to protectyourmove.gov, protectyourmove.gov, and I want to plan a safe interstate move. What am I going to find? What are the resources and tools on that web link?
Yeah, so you're going to find checklists, videos to help you spot red flags. You can either confirm whether a moving company or a broker that you're looking to hire is registered with FMCSA. And when they're registered with FMCSA, you know, you can verify that we at least know who these folks are. You can check those numbers of complaints as well against that registered company. So you can kind of give an understanding of who you're dealing with.
All right. We want to thank Ryan Snyder for being our guest this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Colorectal cancer is now diagnosed more often in adults younger than 50. Experts say symptoms are frequently overlooked or even dismissed. Warning signs like bleeding or ongoing changes in bowel habits can happen months before a diagnosis, leading to delays in care and more advanced disease when cancer is found. If colorectal cancer is caught early, treatment is often successful. Here in Ohio, we see almost 6,000 new cases each year, with our Franklin County listing it among the top cancers in terms of incidence. In February, actor James Vanderbeek, most famous for his role on Dawson's Creek, died from the disease at the tender age of 48. Dr. Marilise Boutros is a member of the American College of Surgeons National Accreditation Program for Rectal Cancer. She joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Why is colorectal cancer being diagnosed more often in adults under 50? I thought this was a 55-plus problem.
You're absolutely right. And that's why the screening age for decades was age 50 and over. And thankfully, we are able to catch cancers earlier and even prevent them in that age group. But we've seen a rise in colorectal cancer in the younger, specifically in the age group of 40 to 50 and even younger still. And so the guidelines have now dropped to age 45 for general risk population and age 40 even for African Americans. But the big question is why?
Do we know what causes colorectal cancer?
Yeah, we know some causes. Ultra-processed foods are a big one. And red meat, as well as nitrated meats like smoked stuff, sausages, cold cuts, all of that. As well, obesity is strongly tied to colorectal polyps. And we know that polyps, if left in place for over 10 to 15 years, can become a cancer. And our sedentary lifestyle. So from an environmental perspective, these three factors go hand in hand and probably explain a big bulk of the rise we're seeing in the young. A lot of research going into this, the microbiome is being looked at carefully and other factors. Unfortunately, genetics doesn't seem to play out a very straightforward role. And these environmental factors have all been heavily associated with colorectal cancer.
No matter what disease we talk about, they always say don't ignore the symptoms. But part of the problem is knowing if you're actually having the symptoms and knowing whether they're worth mentioning to the doctor. So what symptoms should never be ignored regardless of how old you are?
Yeah, totally. Look at your poop. A lot of people don't want to look, but look at it. See if there's any blood in the toilet, blood on the tissue paper, blood on the stool, or blood mixed into the stool. This is the most common warning sign that there's something going on inside. Of course, majority of people will not have colorectal cancer if they see a drop of blood in the toilet bowl. It can definitely be benign things like hemorrhoids or a fissure, but never pass it off as that. Unfortunately, that's what happens all too often. Other warning signs are changes in the shape of the stool. It can become pencil thin or have little nuggets rather than a big formed stool. And maybe not going to the bathroom every day when you were regular before, abdominal pain, bloating, and weight loss. These are some of the warning signs that one should never just disregard and bring them up to their doctor. As well, we've created a checklist at the American College of Surgeons of exactly these symptoms and your family history so that it's all on one paper and easy for you to bring up with your doctor.
So do we think that that's part of the problem, is that young people are simply just ignoring the signs and not dealing with it so that when it comes time for a diagnosis, they're a little further along than they should be?
Right. It is a big part of it. They're also not being screened, so we're not catching it before the symptoms come on. And finally, us, the doctors, are partly to blame because a lot of doctors will just pass it off as hemorrhoids or something else. Most patients who come to me with rectal cancer have had to see more than one family doctor before they were able to get a colonoscopy. And so it is exactly that. Young people are busy, they're resilient, they pass it off to be nothing. But also the healthcare system hasn't been quick to offer colonoscopies in this age group. And hopefully with awareness, we all will do better.
Do you think that 45 number is low enough, or do we need to start thinking about things in our 30s?
I agree with you. I think we're going to lower it more and more as we get more data to support it. And I don't think that 45 is young enough. That was exactly my thought this morning as I was driving in.
You know, I'm bearing down on 60, and when I was 40, I was told, oh, you won't have a colonoscopy until you're 60. And in the last 20 years, every year that number has changed, and it has gotten earlier and earlier and earlier. Now, you can get an over-the-counter test, but is that as accurate as, you know, going to an actual lab?
Really good question. It will catch something if it's pretty advanced already. It'll catch a cancer or a very large polyp, whereas a colonoscopy will catch even a small few millimeter polyp. So we catch it earlier before it can become something bigger. But any screening test is better than no test. Definitely a colonoscopy is the gold standard. It takes out very tiny things. It finds them and takes them out, whereas the stool test that you buy will find larger things. And if it is positive, then you need an actual colonoscopy.
Now, do diseases like diverticulitis or ileitis or Crohn's disease mean that you are at higher risk for colorectal cancer?
Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis have a higher risk of colorectal cancer. So if you have that in your family, bring it up when you're having symptoms or bring it up with your family doctor. Diverticulitis in and of itself doesn't increase your risk of colorectal cancer, but you got to make sure that the episode of diverticulitis was indeed inflammation and not an underlying cancer that is presenting in this way and being called diverticulitis. So if you've had an episode of diverticulitis and have never had a colonoscopy, you should get one once your diverticulitis resolves.
How does this new checklist help patients have better conversations with their doctor? What's on the list?
Oh, that's a good one. It's objective, and it asks about blood in the stool, shape of the stool, abdominal pain, weight loss, and your family history. And it has all the details that the doctor will need to know in order to recommend the right next step. And it's all on one page, so you don't forget, and the doctor doesn't pass it off as just something benign and not offer a colonoscopy. So it's really a conversation starter, and it's super objective. Gets the message across in under a minute.
Can we learn from James Vanderbeek?
Don't ignore those early warning signs. People are shy to talk about what's going on in their poop. People are shy. Nobody wants to go get examined down there. But don't ignore those early warning signs. And find out what's going on in your family. Ask about polyps. Ask about the age that people had polyps at. And finally, not that we could learn that from him, is let's focus on our lifestyle factors that we all have control over.
Now, if you are a research head like I am, you want more information. So what's the best website where we can do a deep dive on this?
At the American College of Surgeons, we've curated all the information and made it very accessible for the layperson. And so at facs.org/CRC for colorectal cancer, we've put it all there.
We want to thank Dr. Marylise Boutros for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz addressed alleged Medicaid fraud in Ohio with Governor Mike DeWine during a visit to Dublin. This comes after reporting by the conservative media outlet The Daily Wire of alleged home health care fraud in Ohio. Dr. Oz said all states, including Ohio, need to have clearer guardrails around programs because if they don't, law enforcement can't go after the fraudsters. But he says he trusts the job Governor DeWine is doing.
We got a big problem. And Ohio is an area that some of this problem has occurred in.
CMS Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz said that, referring to 38% of Medicaid spending on home health care in Ohio happening in Franklin County alone. Oz says the Trump administration believes Ohio, as almost every state, can do a better job implementing guardrails around home health care. Governor DeWine recently signed an executive order addressing Medicaid fraud. It allows the State Department of Medicaid to implement emergency rules targeting providers at high risk for committing fraud. That includes requiring providers to revalidate enrollment more often. The state also placed a moratorium on new home health care providers.
So these are things that we're working with the federal government. We're going to continue to work directly with them and to do everything that we can to stop any kind of fraud.
The governor also estimates the state saves about $600 million a year by keeping Ohioans out of nursing homes and instead allowing them to stay at home receiving home health care. Republican leaders at the State House rolled out their anti-Medicaid fraud bill. State Representative Mike Davila unveiled the Ohio Medicaid Program Integrity and Fraud Prevention Act. The act would boost the electronic verification of in-home personal care services, require the State Department of Medicaid to conduct in-person inspections before approving any new providers, and increase the penalty for Medicaid fraud up to a first-degree felony depending on the amount of fraud committed. In a statement, Davila said, Medicaid was created to serve the truly vulnerable, not to bankroll scammers, fake providers, and organized fraud rings that treat public assistance like an open checkbook. This effort is about restoring accountability, protecting honest Ohioans who are footing the bill, and making sure Medicaid dollars go to the people who actually qualify and truly need help. State Auditor Keith Faber testified before the House Medicaid Committee in support of House Bill 795.
Our message has been consistent. If taxpayers' dollars are stolen, wasted, abused, or spent without proper oversight, we are going to find it, report it, and push for controls needed to stop it from happening again. That's why this bill matters.
Representative Davila says the bill also establishes guidance for state employee fraud reporting and enhances reporting mechanisms to the auditor and attorney general. A bill sponsored by a Democratic state representative takes a different approach to reforming the Medicaid system in Ohio. Back in March, before the allegations of Medicaid fraud came out, Democratic state representative Karen Brownlee introduced the Medicaid Savings Act in the Ohio House. It had its first hearing May 19th in the House Medicaid Committee. The bill would basically restructure how the State Department of Medicaid administers Medicaid for patients. Brownlee says the bill could save the state $1 billion over 2 years by cutting waste and redundancies. I interviewed her a few days ago about how it would do that. What do you make of allegations of Medicaid fraud in Ohio?
So the current allegations that we've been hearing about from the national level have not been substantiated. That's first and foremost. It is a large system. I am sure that waste, fraud, and abuse do occur at all levels. At what amounts at the varying levels, we really don't have a lot of insight. And that does lead me right into House Bill 780, which is the Medicaid Savings Act. We currently know that we've got a very large managed care organization operation that's administering Medicaid. So we started out with 5 managed care organizations, and we now are up to 7 of them. Those 7 companies administer Medicaid insurance to the 3 million Ohioans who use it. And with 7 different administrators, that's 7 different redundancies of administrative cost. And the way that the system is managed, they're really not required to be very transparent. So we don't have a great indication of the accuracy of the medical loss ratio. That medical loss ratio is the amount of money that the companies are spending, managed care organizations are spending on administration and quality assurance product versus actual health care. What we think it is about right now is about 12% of all of the health care costs going into Medicaid are going towards administrative costs right now.
And your bill would switch to an administrative services organization model. What's the difference?
So the difference is that this administrative services only organization would be a single payer program. It would be one line of payment and management and oversight. So it would simplify the processes immeasurably. Not only would it simplify, but it would have different standards of oversight. And so we would have a much clearer picture of what the data on outcomes, health outcomes was, what the data on administrative costs are, and what the outcomes on how much they're actually investing into Ohioans' healthcare versus administrative or overhead costs. Connecticut has moved to this model. They moved on to it about 10 years ago. They have saved $4 billion in Medicaid management while also increasing the number of providers that work under Medicaid and improving health outcomes.
So this bill really focuses in on the waste part of the fraud, waste, and abuse, right?
Correct. I am not accusing any of the MCOs for fraud or abuse in any way, shape, or form. I am simply pointing out the fact that we have 7 managed care organizations that are all charging for the same administrative types of costs across the board, 7 different times. And that administrative overhead cost is taking dollars away from actual health care.
An identical companion bill is in the state Senate. It has also had a first hearing. Senate Bill 386 does have a Democrat and Republican sponsor. A large crowd of family, friends, and supporters gathered to honor a local hero this past Memorial Day. It was the first Memorial Day since Master Sergeant Tyler Simmons of Columbus died in a plane crash in Iraq in the early days of the Iran War. Simmons was a boom operator on KC-135 jets with the 121st Air Refueling Wing at Rickenbacker Air National Guard Base. He and 5 others were killed while serving in support of Operation Epic Fury. Now, his name is being added to the war memorial at Linden Park in Columbus. We were there for the ceremony.
We had hoped to never have to add a name to the war memorial, but tragically, that is not the case.
The name Tyler Simmons will soon take its place of honor on this wall after his death, serving his country at the age of 28.
This is overwhelming in a positive way to have Tyler being remembered like this.
Tyler's father, Milo, says he is very proud of his son because of his service and because he followed his dreams.
He died doing what he loved doing, and so I'm okay with that.
A family feeling the pain of loss.
And your presence reminds us that behind every service member, there's also a family who serves and sacrifices.
Today, our commemoration is dedicated to Air Force Master Sergeant Tyler Simmons, whose life and service represents the best of our community and our country.
Major General John Harris says Tyler was really good at his job as a boom operator, refueling fighter jets going hundreds of miles per hour.
And I'm going to tell you, Tyler Simmons excelled at that, promoted to leadership positions in his unit faster than anybody had ever been promoted.
His family, touched and buoyed by support from the community.
I'd rather have him here. I'd rather not be here doing this. Had it my way, but if it has to be, then we'll take it like this.
And Major Jennifer Green, remembering and honoring a man she says led with integrity, quiet determination, and an open heart.
We salute you, Tyler. Your duty was noble, your sacrifice profound, and your memory forever a part of us. Rest easy, Airmen. We got it from here.
Milo Simmons says he thinks of Tyler as a real American hero, and that is G.I. Joe's slogan. He thinks it would be great to have a Master Sergeant Tyler Simmons boom operator G.I. Joe, because there isn't one of those yet. Two other members of the Ohio Air National Guard were killed in the refueling crash. The 121st Air Refueling Wing remembers Captain Curtis Angst of Wilmington, Ohio, as a strong pilot and leader. He leaves behind a wife. Captain Seth Koval is remembered as one of the wing's best and brightest KC-135 instructor pilots. He leaves behind a wife and son. And this brings us to a conversation 10TV's Station Aken recently had with Governor Mike DeWine about Ohio's commitment to veterans, military members, and their families. The Buckeye State is home to nearly 700,000 veterans, 32,000 military personnel, and more than 16,000 military-connected students. Governor DeWine says Ohio is all in for the military. He plans to make sure our state continues to expand efforts to support veterans, active duty personnel, and military families, even as his time as governor winds down. Stacia has this interview you'll see only on 10.
You have a very special and unique goal that you are aiming for Ohio to be the number one most military-friendly state in the nation. Tell me more about that goal.
You know, we want to be the most military-friendly state for active duty service members, but also the most veteran-friendly state. We have a large number of veterans, obviously, in Ohio. We welcome more to come. And then, you know, if you look at all the service members we have, look at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base with civilian employees as well as the military. 38,000 people go into that one site every single day. And we've got, you know, guard bases all over Ohio. So we're a state that has historically had a great commitment to the military. If you look even back to the Civil War, we sent more people per capita than at any other state did. So we're all in for our military. And, you know, they face unique challenges. They are moved around, you know, with all the ramifications of that. So when I became governor, you know, we were talking to people in the military, and one of the things that they talked about was that spouses who also go along with the military member, they might have a profession too, they might have a career too, and in all likelihood they do. And then sometimes, you know, if it's a teacher, the license doesn't transfer, or if it's someone with a technical skill, maybe that does not transfer. So we've really worked on that to have more reciprocity between the states, and just to do things for that family to recognize the special particular problems that they have. We have, for example, they bring children in to the state. We have open enrollment. You know, the school districts are required to allow open enrollment for those military children. The same way when they go off to college, we treat them as we should. We treat them as Ohio residents. We treat them as Ohio, even though their residence may technically be in Massachusetts or someplace else. So these are just things that, you know, we're able to do, we can do, and we certainly want to do.
In this next step, you're in your final months as governor of the state of Ohio, and someone else will come along and lead the state. How do you plan to assist in the transition of making this a priority in the next administration?
Well, I think that the next administration, I'm sure, will have this as a priority. It's just such a natural thing, I think, for Ohioans to do. But, there are a lot of traditions. We've had traditions with memorial services, and before Memorial Day, we always do a great service. And Fran and I invite all the Gold Star families over to our house afterwards for lunch, and we'll let them know about those traditions, and I'm sure they'll want to carry those on.
Stacia joined local veterans on a recent Columbus Honor flight as they saw the monuments and memorials built in their honor in Washington, D.C. You can watch Honor Flight, Reflections of Service and Sacrifice, now only on the free 10TV streaming app.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS-FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.